Welcome to the People's Palace of the East End of London. And this building is actually the second People's Palace, built after the first one burnt down more than 70 years ago. Sorry, I put my glasses on, I can't see what I'm going to say. This was a part of a joint educational entertainment complex funded by visionary Victorians who wanted to help poor Londoners achieve their full potential. Over time, the East End Technical Schools, which was only part of the People's Palace, took over the whole thing and became Queen Mary College, named after she actually came and opened this building. And over time, Queen Mary College took over the whole People's Palace. And the theatre, the cinema, the gymnasium, the winter gardens, all of that lovely entertainment stuff is all gone, enclosed in a university institution. And that leads on to what I thought was going to be the theme of tonight's meeting, but my speaker tells me maybe it's not, which is about one of the ways that those people who create and maintain resources in common are opposed by people who'd like to enclose the commons. Good, thank you. And how sometimes we win and sometimes they win. And it may seem odd to talk about commons in the context of computer science, but university computer science, of course, is a common established over the last 50 years. And arising out of that common, that free exchange of ideas, is all the variety of computer use that suffuses everyday life today. All those computers in buses and computers in cars and computers on your desk. But 30 years ago, it was a very small and specialized area. It was a sort of priesthood of operators and systems programmers who maintained huge machines in huge buildings, and they got used by technically minded users. And the evolution to a mass activity touching everybody's lives didn't happen by accident. It was that intellectual common, and significantly a community of academic and commonly minded computer scientists who made it happen. And some of it happened almost right here. Just through that wall is what is now called the Skeel Lecture Theatre, but 20 years ago was the Systems Lab of the Department of Computer Science of Queen Mary College, run by George Kaloris, who's in the audience, and who gave lots of us our first proper job. And he was involved in that place in breaking various molds. First of all, we were using an operating system then called Unix. Unix broke a mold of proprietary software. Up to the time that Unix... Part of my job is to wind up the speaker, who will tell you his version of history. He doesn't know that we've already met. Unix broke a mold of proprietary software, which was already bent, but not broken, building on university and military research in the USA. And research was coming out of the AI community, which Richard Stallman came out of. It provided a very simple operating system which is potentially independent of the hardware on which it ran. And Bell Labs, and this is why it broke the mold, Bell Labs gave it away free to universities, and lots of universities took it. Secondly, we were inventing new ways in which computers could be used. And the internet, the windowed GUI and the word processor and the spreadsheet, all of the ideas which underpin the computing which you use every day, came from the free interplay of ideas between academics, industry, and even military researchers. And it may seem odd and unnecessary in a university to talk about free interchange and the necessity of free interchange, but the enclosure of software by powerful forces trying to own the common is a constant risk to the development of our subject and your lives. Here at Queen Mary College, we played mostly with user interfaces. Our intellectual diaspora, which includes Thimbleby at UCL and Newman at Europark, although perhaps Newman was more seaman than diaspora, was widely influential. And we worked on operating systems too, but we didn't have Stallman's courage, and we never tried to provide a truly free alternative to what was beginning to be a corporate vehicle. Over time, the Unix common began to contract as various groups, including some universities, including to our shame this one, tried to make money out of it. It did remain a universal standard by accident, largely because of Sun Computers, which was another university offshoot. And it was during this period that Stallman began the Free Software Foundation, a marvellous project which he intended to keep software as free as it had been when he'd been working in the AI lab in MIT in the years before Unix. His GCC compiler alone, running on various proprietary Unixes, made it possible to keep on creating and distributing free software. And if that was all he had done, his worth to the computer science community would be enormous. But he's done much more. He kept the Free Software Project Foundation project alive, and it led eventually to what is popularly called Linux, but Stallman insists should be called GNU Linux, because rightly, the Free Software Foundation's GNU software is most of it, and the Linux kernel is only a part. Tonight is about copyright. 20 years ago, I stood on a platform with George Kaloris, or sat on a platform with George Kaloris at the British Library, and told them that copyright, which they thought was threatened by the photocopier, was actually going to be destroyed by digital copying. They then asked me to be on a working party about copyright, and I said no, because I told them all I knew about copyright. That was it. It seemed most of us at that time, that copyright was broken and dead. Digital copies are effortless, free, and perfect. And those of us who were authors were worried about the consequences to our income, but we saw doom. We didn't reckon on the ingenuity of the enclosers. In particular, copyright holders in this country have always been ingenious. In the last century alone, they restricted free public lending libraries in lending gramophone records, prevented them rebinding paperback books, and with the public lending right, managed to stop free lending entirely. They extended copyright to a ludicrous 70 years from the death of the author. And now they're actively looking and finding ways, using modern computing technology, to control the use of copyrighted material after it's been sold to anybody, not just to libraries, and legislators are helping them. And this country and the European Union in general is not far behind the USA in passing copyright-friendly laws. We're proud to welcome Richard Stallman to enlighten us on the state of this particular battle. He's an outstanding individual who took himself out of the AI lab. He took himself out of the AI lab at MIT, one of the seminal sources of university computer science since the 1960s. He founded the Free Software Foundation, started the battle for free software, and he continues it to this day. That battle isn't won and probably never will be, but it certainly isn't lost, and he's held the line for 20 years. And it's due to him that we have a present and we're able to contemplate a future in which free software like GNU Linux is a rival to the major proprietary software models like Windows and Mac OS and all the rest of the horrible mess. Copyright looks to me as though it's going to be an even harder struggle. These last 2 days in the Register, by chance, there have been three. The Register, if you don't know it, is a wonderful subversive online newspaper, biting the hand that feeds IT, as they put it. Three articles in the Register in the past 3 days, one detailing how Philips, to its credit, is trying to stop other people, to their discredit, selling CDs that don't work except unless you buy special CD players which will not play uncopyrighted CDs. Another one dealing with how Microsoft has appointed a lawyer, not a technical person, to head their famous thrust for security, the Register has a splendidly paranoid interpretation of that, which I won't try to repeat because it might be illegal, and one about saying how Sky is capable of, and perhaps may even be thinking of, stopping your recording programs off air. All of these various things stopping us doing things which we thought we could do just because we already owned a copy of a document are things which are happening right now, and Richard Stallman is going to talk, amongst other things, about that. Thank you.
Is this what I should use?
That's I'm supposed to switch this on. So
okay.
No, you're speaking for
please?
That
one
up there.
Oh.
Clip that onto your T-shirt if you like.
Oh, okay. This is made...
That didn't do anything. That's a tape recorder.
Oh, this is a tape recorder only.
That's the live one.
Oh, okay. Well, this was obviously made for somebody wearing a strangler. And I don't wear stranglers, so I always have trouble putting them on. Well, Since the speech I was supposed to give normally takes an hour, and they scheduled this for two, I've got to do something with that. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about free software as an introduction, because the speech about copyright versus community is really about where we can take the ideas of free software beyond software. So it flows out of free software. I might as well give you the introduction to get it going. In the 1970s, I was part of a community of programmers, and we shared the software we wrote. And in the lab where I worked, all the software we use was from this community. It was all shared. If you came over and you asked for some program, we'd say, yeah, take a copy. Here it is. Make use of it. Do something good with it. We were working to advance human knowledge, not to attack and hold back somebody else. But this community sort of died in the early 1980s. And from the experiences that happened, I came to, when I got to see what proprietary software was like, what the alternative was like, which was the way most computer users had been living for years, I thought, this is morally ugly. I refuse to live this way. But what could I do? At that point, all the operating systems for modern computers were proprietary, including Unix. That is, to get them, you had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Now, for a while at a university, they wouldn't charge you a lot of money, but you still had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. And a non-disclosure agreement means a promise not to teach others. For people who believe in advancing human knowledge, there can be nothing more vicious than a promise not to teach others. It attacks directly the root of the idea of learning and of human knowledge. So the only way I could work with computers and not be part of that ugly world was to build another operating system. And as soon as I realized that this was the way it had to be done, I realized I had been elected by circumstances to do the job. I was an operating system developer. I had exactly the skills necessary to tackle this job. That didn't mean I knew I would succeed, but at least I could try. And nobody else was looking at this as a serious problem that needed to be solved. If I didn't solve this problem, chances are nobody else would. So I realized that this was the most important thing I could see to possibly do with my life. I decided I would write a free software operating system or die trying, probably of old age, I guess. I decided to make this system similar to Unix because Unix was portable and I wanted this system to be portable too. I knew it would take several years to get such a system working, and by then I didn't know what kinds of computers would be popular. I didn't want to have to try to guess and then have the whole project be worthless if I guessed wrong. Instead, much better to make a portable system. And Unix, since it was portable, provided a design that I could follow and have a reasonable chance of getting it to work. So I decided to make a Unix-compatible free software operating system, and then I gave it the name GNU, following a tradition of programmer's humor. See, those of us programmers who call ourselves hackers, we approach programming in the spirit of playful cleverness. That's what it means to be a hacker. You enjoy playful cleverness. And part of that is, when you're writing a program, you try to give it a funny or mischievous name. And then imagining people laughing at the name is half the fun of writing the program. There must be a hacker out there somewhere. And we had a hacker tradition that if you're writing a program that is similar to some existing program, which in the days of non-portable programs we had to do very often, you know, there was an existing program that ran on computer A, and you want to do that thing on computer B, you're going to have to write another program, which would be similar, but of course you change it in various ways with your own ideas. And the hacker tradition was you could give it a name, which is a recursive acronym that says this program is not the other one. So there were many TECO text editors, more or less similar, called this TECO or that TECO or whoosie what's this TECO. But one hacker called his version TINT, for TINT is not TECO, the first recursive acronym. And we thought that was so funny, we started looking for recursive acronyms for lots of programs. I wrote a text editor called Emacs in 1975, and when people started making imitations of it, one of them was called Fine, for Fine is not Emacs, and there was Sign, and Ina, for Ina is not Emacs, and Mince, for Mince is not complete Emacs. And then Ina was almost completely rewritten, and the new version was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. So I looked for a recursive acronym for something is not Unix. And I tried all 26 letters, and I discovered none of them made a word. So they weren't funny. I mean, if it just stands for something is not Unix and it doesn't have another meaning, it's not a joke. So I said, well, I've got to do it another way. I made a contraction. That way I could make a three-letter recursive acronym. And I started trying letters, ANU, BNU, KNU, DNU, ENU, FNU, GNU. Well, GNU is the funniest word in the English language. So I had my name. By the way, I've read that the correct pronunciation of that word includes a click sound. It's borrowed, I believe, from a dying African language. So don't worry about people who say it's supposed to be pronounced new. When it's the name of our operating system, please pronounce it with a hard G. If you talk about the new operating system, you'll get people very confused. We've been working on it for 18 years now, so it's not new anymore. But it still is, and it always will be GNU, no matter how many people call it Linux by mistake. So through the 80s, we were adding pieces to this system. By the early 90s, the system was almost finished. Turns out the design of units consists of many separate components, which made it easy to have a worldwide distributed project work on it, because each hacker could write some piece, or maybe two hackers or three hackers could get together. You know, programmers who don't have the hacker spirit were welcome too, but they were less likely to volunteer. So eventually we had all the system done except for one of the important pieces, which is the kernel. It's one of several pieces without which the system is nothing. And we started working on a kernel in 1990, but before we got it done, somebody else wrote a free kernel called Linux, and he got it to work. So other people then fitted Linux into the gap in the GNU system, and the combination was a complete system, the GNU/Linux system. And so this was a tremendous milestone. It meant the goal we set out in 1984 to achieve had been reached. But at the same time, the great confusion arose, the idea that the whole system was Linux. And when people hear that, they naturally tend to assume that the whole thing was started in 1991 by Linus Torvalds. And then when they hear about GNU, they have to imagine some kind of role for us which would be consistent with that mistaken assumption. So that from this one false belief, they construct other false beliefs, and eventually they end up with a whole picture that's completely skewed. And so I after seeing this happen, I came to the conclusion the only way we can avoid teaching people a whole bunch of mistakes is if we stop calling the system just Linux. So there's, you know, a lot of the pieces were written by the GNU project. One important piece was written by Linus. If you call it GNU/Linux, you're giving us equal mention, and we really need it. Now, why do we need it so much? There are lots of other people working on free programs, as long as nobody's prohibiting them from doing so. Unfortunately, that happens fairly often, that somebody tries to prohibit them from doing so. And even if people forgot about GNU, development of the GNU/Linux system would continue when there is no tremendous obstacle. But there are areas where we face major obstacles. People who have imbibed the philosophy of Linux, which is it's fun to have software that you can share and change, when they come to one of these obstacles, they'll say, well, I'll do something else. So these obstacles remain permanent problems. It's going to take determined effort to overcome these obstacles. It's going to take people who recognize that there's an issue of freedom at stake here, that they're fighting for their freedom, that these non-free programs are programs that don't recognize your freedom and that deny you freedom, that they are problems to be solved by replacing them so that you don't use them anymore, or by whatever other method shows up. They're not inferior solutions to be accepted until something better happens to arrive. They're problems to be actively solved. And that's the philosophy that people hear in connection with GNU. That's the philosophy of the free software movement. The philosophy of free software is that you're entitled to the freedom to study what a program really does, to change it in case it doesn't do what you want, change it to do the things you need, and to redistribute copies to other people so that you can share knowledge with the rest of humanity. No society can afford to put obstacles in the way of sharing knowledge with the rest of humanity. So, this philosophy of free software is what we have been working for 18 years now, with a certain amount of success. We do have free operating systems. We are having an increasing number of free applications to run on top of them. And there are many people who see practical benefits as well resulting from these freedoms. Now, it's true, when people have freedom, that tends to bring practical benefits. After all, the freedom to do something you don't want to do, like clean a toilet with your tongue, is not going to be a big political issue. If there were a law against cleaning toilets with your tongue, I don't think very many people would demonstrate in the street against this law. Clearly, issues of freedom are important when it's the freedom to do something that people find useful to do, people actually want to do sometimes. Then they get angry when their freedom is taken away. Then it's an issue of some significance. And so there are many people who have found that they appreciate the practical benefits they get from having freedom to help themselves and help their neighbors. And yet many of them refuse to recognize this as an ethical or political issue. They treat it as purely a technical issue. You know, yes, we recommend allowing people to study and change and redistribute the software because that helps us develop more powerful software faster, gives better technical results. And that's all they say. That's as deep as they go. That philosophy is called the open source movement. That's the the name that these people have chosen for themselves, the people who promote that view. We in the free software movement recognize these practical benefits as things that often happen, and they're nice to have, but they're not the be-all and end-all. They're not the most important goal. The most important goal is to be able to live in an upright way, treating your friends decently, helping them when they ask you for help. Basically, to live as part of a society instead of a dog-eat-dog jungle. And so this is why when people talk to me about open source, I always say, that's not what I do. That's another group. Almost every day people write to me, asking if I could tell them something about open source. Or, you know, one person said, after my speech this weekend, could they interview me for 10 minutes about open source? And I said, well, I'm sorry, that's not what I do. If you're really interested in open source, you'll have to find someone who supports that. The people who support the open source movement, who only consider technical advantages and disadvantages, they have a right to promote their views. Those views are not my views. And I don't want my work to be labeled with the label of their party. And of course, whenever I send such a response, I always give somebody the option of deciding that he's actually interested in free software, and then I'll cooperate and give him the interview or answer questions for his report or give him advice or whatever it is he's wanting. I'm not trying to find an excuse to say no to people, but I'm trying to find a hook to use to educate them. And I always tell them where they can look on our website to find more information about this. Our website is www.gnu.org, and the /philosophy directory is the place where you'll find information about topics like these. And for the history of GNU, you would look in the /GNU directory. So, a few years ago, probably early in the 90s, when I started giving more speeches, people sometimes started asking me if these ideas could apply to anything other than software. Sometimes they did this in a shallow, derisive fashion. They'd say, well, what about hardware? Should hardware be free too? Well, let's look at the same issues if we apply them to hardware. The issues are you free to run it? Are you free to study what it does? Free to modify it? And free to make copies and redistribute them? Well, consider this microphone. Are you free to copy this microphone and redistribute it? Well, that's a hard thing to do. We don't have copiers for microphones, except in Star Trek, where you could detune the transporter and then it might do the job. Basically, automatic trivial copiers exist for information entities, not for physical objects. A physical object has to be made on a manufacturing line. And usually the factory ends up getting specifically designed for the product it's making. You know, if you can't copy a sandwich, maybe you could make another sandwich like it. But to do that, you're going to have to get raw materials and you're going to have to prepare them and assemble them. You can't just say, okay, food copier, copy the sandwich. And what about modifying it? Well, if I owned this microphone, nobody'd stop me from modifying it. Yeah, I could cut off part of the length of this tube if I wanted to, or add a new bass to it, or any change at all. No one's going to stop me. Of course, it's not necessarily easy to do. If I wanted to change a computer, it's very hard to change the inside of a chip and have it still work at all. Nobody can do that. You know, back in the 60s and 70s, people actually used to modify computers in substantial ways. We got a PDP-10 and we added memory translation to it. We added a paging box. The PDP-10 didn't come with paging. And that was around 1970, but you know, in the 60s, there were people who got computers and they modified them, adding a whole pile of new instructions. All sorts of interesting changes they added. Maybe that was a way for students to learn hardware design skills, add a feature to the computer. So the issues of free software don't translate to physical objects. They only make sense for information. So let's look at those issues applied to information. Of course, they make sense for published information. You know, there are other kinds of information like personal information, which are completely different ethical issues. I think it's entirely reasonable to expect that your doctor should keep your medical records secret. I sure wish the police didn't have the right to barge in and look at them whenever they felt like it. I think it would be reasonable to expect your internet service provider to keep the records of what you had done secret. The police shouldn't be making them keep these records and keep a permanent dossier on everything you've ever done, which is what the government of the UK is trying to set up. And therefore, let's limit the topic to published information, information that in some way or another is available to you and is available somehow to other people in principle. There's no question of secrecy there. So the question is, once you've got a copy, what should you be allowed to do with it? Should you have the freedom to study it inside and out? Should you have the freedom to modify it? Should you have the freedom to redistribute unmodified copies? Should you have the freedom to distribute modified copies? These are issues that all make sense for any kind of published information. But what are the answers to them? Now, I think it's a mistake, a fundamental mistake in thinking, to take a conclusion from one example and then try to generalize it to whenever you don't see a big obstacle to generalization. And the reason is that lots of areas of life involve trade-offs between different goals. In other words, they involve paying a price to get something. And a good price to buy this thing may not be a good price to pay to get that thing. You know, to get a new car for £500 is a wonderful deal, probably. To get a container of milk for £500 is a horrible deal. But the price is the same. The same price is not a good price for everything. So, when we're dealing with ethical questions, what's the right way to handle this situation or that situation, analogy tells us very little. Analogy can suggest an answer you might want to consider, but it's never a good reason to reach a conclusion. The way you can reach conclusions about ethical issues is by looking at the various alternatives and seeing what their consequences are. Are those consequences good or bad? And then you can choose among the alternatives. Now, the basic principles of ethics don't change. People might learn about them, but they are not changed just by developments in technology, say. They're too fundamental to be affected by changes in technology. But the consequences of a given set of choices are affected by the context including the technology that people have available. Today, if I said, you're not allowed to copy sandwiches, it would be an irrelevancy. There are no sandwich copiers. But 100 years from now, if there are sandwich copiers, that might be an extremely important political issue, which might have millions or billions of people up in arms. Because the change in technology alters the consequences of the same set of alternatives, and therefore affects which of these alternatives is a good choice. This has happened tremendously in regard to the history of copyright. So let me talk about the history of copyright and connect it with the history of copying. We've seen a number of changes in copying technology through the millennia. In the ancient world, copying a book was done with a pen and ink. You read one copy and you write another. That was the best technology anybody had, and it had certain consequences. First of all, just about anybody who was literate could copy books reasonably easily, that is, as easily as anybody else. It's true that if you spent all day copying books, you'd get somewhat better at it, but not many orders of magnitude better. And another consequence was there was very little economy of scale. To make 10 copies took about 10 times as long as making one copy. And another consequence was nothing insisted that the copies had to be identical to each other. And in the ancient world, there was a continuum between copying a book and writing a book. Of course, they understood the difference. They would recognize, oh, this is a play by Sophocles. It was written by, the author is Sophocles. They understood that concept. But in between writing a play and copying a play, there might be other things, there were other things that you could do. For instance, you might copy part of a certain book and then write some more text of your own, and then copy some more and write some more, and so on. This was writing a commentary. And it was a useful thing to do. Some of them became popular. Or you might copy a passage from a certain book and write some text of your own, and then copy something from another book and write something of your own, and copy from a third book and write something of your own. Compendia such as these were also very useful and popular. And there are books that are lost, but parts of them survive where they were quoted in something else. And sometimes substantial parts were quoted. Now, as far as I can tell, there was no such thing as copyright in the ancient world. Anyone anywhere who had a book and wanted to copy it could do so. But technology advanced. Printing was developed. The printing press changed the nature of copying. It made copying easier, more efficient, but not in a uniform way, because it was a lot of work to set type and much less work to make each copy from the type that had been set. And the result was that there was now a tremendous economy of scale for making many identical copies. It also meant that specialized equipment was needed. Not every literate person had a printing press and type. In fact, only a small number of them did. It was a substantial investment. Essentially, if you had a printing press, you were now a publisher. (Clears throat) It meant, because of the economy of scale, that typically copies of any one book were only going to be available from a small number of places. And they were going to be made in quantity and then distributed from the place where they were produced. Now, copyright was developed along with the printing press. The first place I think I know of copyright was in Italy in the 1500s. Some people have claimed that there was a kind of copyright in medieval Ireland, but if you look closely, it wasn't a copyright. It was simply a monopoly on publication for certain organizations. A blanket monopoly, and had nothing to do with the authors. Now, copyright fit in fairly well with the printing press technology of the time. Oh, one other point. When there was a printing press, that didn't mean people immediately stopped copying by hand. Handmade copies continued to be made, sometimes by very rich people to show off how rich they were, and sometimes by poor people who couldn't afford even a printed copy. But, you know, there's a song that says, "Time ain't money if all you got is time." And that's the reason why poor people sometimes copied books by hand. They had time to do that, but they had no money. Well, copyright fit in well with printing press technology. For one thing, it had the nature of an industrial regulation. Copying by printing press could only be done by those few who had printing presses. So copyright didn't restrict the actions of readers in general, only of these few businesses. Copyright was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced on publishers. And one of the things about publishing is if you want to sell copies, you have to tell people where you are and what you've got. So you're easy to find. There was no need to break into people's houses to see if they were violating copyright. And in fact, although people continued to make copies of books by hand, there was no attempt to enforce copyright law against them. It was understood as an industrial regulation. Well, actually, in England, it was first understood as a means of censorship. I believe that the Statute of Anne was actually more of a censorship system than anything else, but it evolved into a system of a different nature. And finally, it might have been beneficial in the age of the printing press. Beneficial in what sense, though? Well, when the U.S. Constitution was being drawn up, there was a proposal that authors should be entitled to a monopoly on printing their writings. This proposal was rejected. Instead, a different proposal was adopted, which says that Congress has the power, not the obligation, only the power, to promote progress by adopting a system that we now know as copyright. In other words, the system is stated to exist for the sake of promoting the progress of science, actually. And how is it supposed to do this? Well, it provides an incentive. The idea is that if copyright makes it easier for authors to make a living, they will write more books, and then all of us will get the benefit of the consequences of this. More books that we can read, more books available in the bookstore, and also the benefit of the discussion of ideas that is the result from people publishing books. So the purpose was social benefit, not benefit for private parties. The purpose of copyright is to modify the behavior of copyright holders, not to specifically to benefit them. So it doesn't reflect an idea that they are somehow more important than other people. It's an attempt to motivate them to do work. And it could be that this trade was a good one. You see, it's thought of as a trade. People speak of the copyright bargain, where the public trades the freedom to make copies and in exchange gets those benefits. Well, in the age of the printing press, this trade had an interesting characteristic. The public was trading a freedom it could not exercise. If you didn't have a printing press, you couldn't mass produce copies. So the freedom to do so was an irrelevancy. It was moot. So when you have something that's of no use to you whatsoever, if anyone offers to take it off your hands for a non-zero price, that's probably a good deal. So copyright in the age of the printing press was probably a good deal for the public. Now, technology continued to evolve. Printing got cheaper. Eventually, I think around 1900, printing got so cheap that hardly anybody, not even poor people, bothered to write out copies by hand anymore. And so the idea that that was done by poor people got forgotten. We came to think that copies were always made on printing presses. Copying was synonymous with publishing. But then came digital information technology. The age of the printing press is starting to be left behind. This transition is not complete, and I don't know how long it will take or if it ever will be total. But digital technology is becoming an important method for the public to manipulate and redistribute information. And already in the 1970s, people began to notice that there was a conflict between the capabilities that digital information technology gives to the public and the desires of the publishers that the public should not have these capabilities. Since the publishers typically dominated the debate, they said that digital technology created problems for copyright, effectively elevating copyright to the status of an end in itself, forgetting that it's a means, or inviting us to forget that it's a means. You'll find they frequently do that. Now, I would say, rather, copyright creates problems for digital information technology. It creates obstacles for the users of digital information technology, stopping us from doing the useful things with it, stopping it from using it for what it's good for and what it's designed for. Copyright in the age of the printing press was an industrial regulation. It restricted a small number of businesses. Copyright in the age of the computer network is a restriction on the general public. You see, with digital technology, we've gone back to a state of affairs more like the ancient world, where anybody who can use the material can copy it about as well as anybody else. There is no gigantic economy of scale in making these copies. No reason why they have to be made in a few centralized places and shipped in physical form from there. It's not necessary or useful anymore, except to those who want to funnel all the copying through their toll gate. Another change is I'm getting a little bit confused. I'm a bit too sleepy. collect my thoughts. Now, I don't want to take questions yet. I'd rather save them for the end. And there should be plenty of time for them. So, copyright was set up as a system to let authors restrict publishers for the sake of the general public. The digital technology is transformed into a system to let publishers restrict the public in the name of the authors. So its role in society has been completely reversed. Copyright used to be an industrial regulation. Now it's a restriction on the general public. Copyright used to be easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced on publishers, and publishers, by their nature, are advertising to the public and easy to find. Now it's hard to enforce. It requires essentially intruding into everybody's life, restricting what they're allowed to do with their computers, prohibiting useful software because it enables them to get too much use out of their computers. Copyright used to be fairly uncontroversial as a consequence of being an industrial regulation and easy to enforce. Now it's starting to stir up opposition from the public who see that they are being restricted. And finally, copyright used to be a beneficial trade for the public. The public traded away a freedom which in practice it could not exercise. Now it can exercise this freedom. Now this freedom is not useless and worthless in itself. Now it's useful. What do you do when you've been producing a byproduct and selling it to somebody who wanted to take it off your hands, and now you have a use for that byproduct? What you do is you keep some of it. Maybe you still sell part of it, but you keep what you want to use. And that's what the public is starting to want to do with these freedoms to use published materials. They formerly were useless to the general public, and the public traded them away beneficially. Now the rational thing for the public to do is keep some of them, reduce the size of the copyright bargain, sell only parts of those freedoms, keep the rest, and exercise them. That's what makes sense from the point of view of the public, to reduce the extent of copyright powers so that the public has more rights. That's not what the publishers want to do with copyright, however. And the publishers, through their various means of dominating politicians, have controlled the developments thus far. In the U.S., they do this by campaign contributions, a form of essentially legalized bribery. I don't know how the system operates in the UK, but it seems to operate. It's the same here? What? The what is? Yeah, okay, so basically that's what it is. The politicians don't represent the public anymore. They represent businesses. And the result is that we've been getting laws that go in exactly the opposite of the direction that would benefit the public, which drastically increase copyright powers. The idea of the publishers is to clamp down completely, to stop you from using your computers in any way they don't like. Their ultimate goal is that you should be forced to pay every time you read or listen to or watch anything. Consider, for instance, e-books, which were highly touted over the past few years. Touted, I'm convinced, as part of a well-funded PR campaign. Funded by the publishers, of course. They didn't want to leave it up to the public to just decide if they liked using ebooks. They wanted to make the public want ebooks. A year ago, I was flying in an airplane in Brazil, and in the in-flight magazine, the editorial talked about e-books and how there were a few temporary wrinkles because of a disagreement between two formats, and it wasn't clear which would be the standard. But surely, and by 10 years from then, we would all be using e-books. That must have been paid for. It's inconceivable that they would have chosen that topic and that slant because they thought the public was tremendously interested. After all, it doesn't sell travel, which is the primary purpose of these magazines. So, why this well-funded campaign? I think it's part of a two-step plan to take away readers' traditional freedoms. You know, freedoms to do things like sell a book to a used bookstore, or buy it from one, or lend it to a friend, or buy it from, or borrow it from a public library, or keep it for a few years and read it again, or buy it anonymously without handing over your name to be put in a database that records everything you've read. All of these freedoms are taken away by e-books. Now, if the publishers propose the law taking away these freedoms for printed books, they probably couldn't get that through because there'd be too much uproar. So they worked out a two-step plan. First, they would take away these freedoms for e-books and have no opposition because there were no e-books and nobody was attached to these freedoms in that domain because there was nobody in that domain. Then the next step is, having established this regime of domination, then switch people from printed books to e-books. And they will come to e-books thinking that, oh, e-books of course are restricted like this. They've always been restricted like this. How else would it ever be? And if they ever got people succeeded in getting people switched over, they would have succeeded in taking away the traditional freedoms of readers. By the way, this reminds me of a further piece of 1984-ish doublespeak, is when they talk about putting a new restriction on the public, they call it establishing a right. Be on the lookout for it and don't tolerate it. Every time it comes up, correct it. They may pass laws, they may establish legal lawyers' customs of speaking, but they don't get to decide what things really are. So, in the United States, this was done with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, a law that essentially allows publishers to write their own copyright law by implementing it in software. If the publishers publish the data, the text, the movie, the music, whatever, in some kind of restricted format, and it's set up such that it's hard to access the data in certain ways, that the technology implements certain restrictions, then the Digital Millennium Copyright Act prohibits anything that would bypass those restrictions. So the publishers can make any restrictions they like, as long as they implement them technologically. Now, if it were just technology, of course, people would find their way around it. Technology alone does not succeed in restricting people. It takes the power of government force to impose these restrictions on the public. They're being imposed by force on behalf of the publishers. A few years ago, some people in Europe, including a 16-year-old Norwegian programmer, worked out the way movies are stored on a DVD. And they developed a free program to access the data off the DVD, thus laying the groundwork to make it possible to watch a DVD that you have bought using free software on your free GNU/Linux operating system. The movie companies sued the people in the U.S. who were distributing copies of this program and made them stop. And recently, Jon Johansson, the 16-year-old who's now a few years older, has been charged with a crime in Norway at the behest of the U.S. government. There are protests starting to happen in Norway. Last summer, a Russian programmer was arrested before he could leave the U.S. and charged with helping to write in Russia a program that converted these restricted ebooks into an open format that free software could access and that many programs could access and that you could copy and use flexibly. This program was legal in Russia, but it was illegal in the U.S. And so at the request of Adobe, which is clearly essentially our master in this area, the United States government arrested him. And protests began weekly in several cities. Protests against the arrest of Dmitry Skryarov and also protesting against the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Skryarov was released a few weeks ago. He agreed to testify to certain facts. The U.S. government is presenting this as agreeing to testify against his employer. The employer says that's not the way it is. In any case, he has been allowed to return to Russia. But Russian programmers must be afraid of visiting the U.S. now, afraid that they will be arrested because of unjust reasons. It used to be that Americans had to be afraid of visiting Russia, that they would be arrested unjustly. It used to be the Soviet Union that made the strenuous attempts to crush forbidden copying, samizdat. Now it's the United States which does this. The Soviet Union employed a range of methods to stamp out forbidden copying. First of all, they had guards watching copying equipment to check what you copied, to make sure it wasn't something that was forbidden. Second, those who they caught doing forbidden copying were punished harshly, imprisoned for years or sent to Siberia. Third, to help catch people, they asked for informers. They asked everyone to rat on their neighbors or coworkers to the information police. Fourth, to help catch people also, they used collective responsibility. You're going to watch that group. If I catch any of them doing forbidden copying, you are going to prison, so watch them carefully. And fifth, propaganda starting from childhood to convince people that only a vicious enemy of the people would ever do this forbidden copying. The United States today is using all of these methods. First, guards watching copying equipment. In copying stores, that's what the staff do. But watching what you copy on your computer would be too expensive with human labor. So instead, they put robot guards into your computer. That's what the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is all about. Second, harsh punishments for people who do forbidden copying. 10 years ago in the U.S., if you made copies of something and handed them out to your friends just to be helpful, that was not a crime. It had never been a crime. Now it's a felony. You could be put in prison for years for sharing published information with your neighbors. Third, soliciting informers. There are ads in the subways, there are ads on television asking people to rat on their coworkers to the information police. which is otherwise known as the Business Software Alliance. And they send really nasty letters to people saying, have you been checked for compliance recently? I'm sure you're violating the law. You, of course, should be scared of prison. It's really trying to terrorize people. In Argentina, the letters they sent threatened people with getting raped in prison if they had forbidden copies of software. And fourth, collective responsibility. In the U.S., this has been done by conscripting internet service providers, making them responsible for what their customers post. The only way they can get out of this is if they take down all material within 2 weeks of any complaint. And fifth, propaganda starting in childhood. That's what they use the word pirate for. To describe a forbidden copy as pirate, or to describe the people who share with their neighbors as pirates, is a perverted idea of morality designed to convince everyone that sharing with your neighbor is the moral equivalent of attacking a ship. If you don't believe that, I hope you won't say it. Don't use the word pirate to describe this activity. Now, it's no accident, this similarity. The motive for stopping people from copying and sharing information in the U.S. today is different from the motive in the Soviet Union 20 years ago. But the methods have to be the same, and it leads to the same kind of police state. And I'm sad to say that it's no longer limited to the United States, because the European Union has adopted a new copyright directive which requires the same things. It makes it a crime to develop programs like the one Dmitry Skyarov wrote, like the one Jon Johansson wrote. This directive must be repealed, and it must be defied. It's a form of tyranny on behalf of the publishers. But what should we do with copyright in the age of the computer networks? Well, clearly we should reduce the extent of copyright powers. Now that these freedoms are not useless to the general public should keep some of them and use them. That's what it wants to do. But which parts? First of all, there are several dimensions about how far copyright extends, several dimensions that can be varied independently. One dimension is how long copyright lasts. Copyright used to last, 28 years, I think? Now it's up to 70 years after the author dies. I think it's probably something like, in the case of a work made for hire, I think it's 95 years. Now, the companies that passed that extension in the U.S. were saying that they needed this extension of copyright in order to make their business profitable. I challenged them to supply projected balance sheets for 76 years in the future. None of them attempted to do so. This, of course, was just bullshit. The reason what they wanted this extension was that there were some works that were still popular that were written about 74 years ago, and they didn't want those works to go into the public domain. In fact, they don't want those works to go into the public domain ever. But the U.S. Constitution says that copyright has to last for, quote, a limited time, unquote. So they can't pass a law that says copyright is perpetual. Therefore, they came up with the idea of perpetual copyright on the installment plan, where every 20 years they extend the term of copyright by another 20 years. So no copyright will ever expire again. That's the idea. In particular, Disney didn't want the copyright on Mickey Mouse to expire. So we refer to this as the Mickey Mouse Copyright Act. So the length of time, the duration of copyright is one dimension. But another dimension is which activities it covers. For instance, copyright, there's commercial distribution and there's non-commercial. You know, copyright could cover commercial distribution but not non-commercial distribution. That might make sense for some kinds of works. There is verbatim distribution and there's publishing modified versions. Those are different questions. Copyright could say different things about them. And there are other distinctions that can be made, too. We should not aim for the simplest and most uniform possible copyright laws because that gives us a small number of extreme choices. It's as if you decided you were going to go shopping and you would pay for any item either £1 or £1,000, but nothing in between ever. That would clearly put you at a disadvantage. Much better to have a broader range of possible choices for how much you want to pay for any given item. So, now that we see what the dimensions of variation are, let's look at, I'm almost ready to talk about what I think we should do, but I have to prepare one other thing. We shouldn't treat all kinds of works alike, just as we don't pay the same amount for a container of milk or a car. Why assume that all kinds of published works have to be treated the same? Actually, they're not all treated the same. Music is treated very differently. But aside from that, all literary works are treated the same. Why should they be treated the same? Well, it's clear why the publishers want uniformity, because then they can pick one of all the various kinds of work, they can pick one kind where they say, in this area you need this much copyright power, or we claim we need this much copyright power, and by the principle of uniformity, there has to be this much power across the board. That's the way they make the argument. But once you reject this unnecessary requirement of uniformity, then you can just tailor the amount of copyright power to what you think is advantageous for any given kind of work. And keeping in mind the kinds of social uses that are useful to society for different kinds of works. And that varies. Thinking about this, I've identified three broad categories of different kinds of works. First, there are functional works, works that you use to get a job done. Second, there are works that represent someone's thought. Their utility is that they tell you what certain people thought or saw or want or believe or are willing to do. And then the third category is aesthetic or entertaining works, works where the sensation you get from looking at the work is the whole point. So these three categories of works, I believe, need to be thought about separately when we think about what copyright should do. Functional works include computer programs, recipes, reference works, manuals and textbooks, and maybe other things. And you'll note, for instance, that people who use recipes make a practice of copying them and redistributing them and changing them. Cooks often change a recipe. They may change it successively, evolving it, and get a version of this recipe that they really like. And then their friends may enjoy eating it and say, hey, could I have the recipe? And so the kind of evolution of software that goes on in the free software community was prefigured by perhaps centuries by the evolution of recipes in the cooking community. And for exactly the same reasons. So, all the conclusions I reached for software, that you have to have the freedom to study it, modify it, redistribute it, even publish a modified version, all these conclusions apply to all kinds of functional works, such as recipes and dictionaries and encyclopedias and manuals and textbooks. And there are projects beginning to replace all of these things with free works, works where you do have those freedoms. There are now several commercially published free manuals for free software. I think one publisher has six of them. They sell copies, of course. They're a commercial organization. They're in that to make money. But when you buy a copy, you have all these freedoms, and the source code is available. Well, I say source code, I mean the marked up text that you could format and conveniently edit. It's not really source code in the sense of a program. There are free dictionary projects, including a free Spanish dictionary and a free dictionary of Walloon. And these projects, by their success, show that we can make free dictionaries for any language, and we should. Another area is free textbooks. There's now at least one free textbook of computer science. There's also a free encyclopedia project that's going great guns. When I published an article a couple of years ago urging the need for free encyclopedias and dictionaries, or specifically though for a free encyclopedia, I thought it might take 20 years. Now I don't think it'll take that long. I think that in 5 years we will have a rather copious free encyclopedia. I believe that there are tens of thousands of articles already. So that's the area of functional works, where we really have to make sure that people have full freedom to use these works, although there can be requirements of attribution and other things to help make versions of the work more useful. In the GNU free documentation license, which we designed for these things, there are provisions for preservation of acknowledgments, preservation of information about the history of the work itself, where to find previous versions. There can be endorsements which have to be deleted in any modified version. So suppose there's a book which is endorsed, suppose it's about some area of medicine. Well, some board or some association of doctors could endorse that version. And people are allowed to make modified versions, but they have to delete the endorsements so that there's no confusion about which version is actually officially regarded as valid by whatever body. People who make the modified versions would have to seek their own endorsements for those. But then when we get to the other categories of works, the questions are different. The same questions can be asked, but I think the answers are partly different. For works that represent somebody's views, I don't believe that publishing a modified version is a useful activity for society. In effect, that's misrepresenting somebody. These works include essays of opinion, memoirs, scientific papers that are witnessing the results of an experiment, catalogs and offers to buy and sell, and probably some other things as well, all of which are primarily of use because they say what a certain person thought, they or saw, or believes, or wants. So only verbatim copying, I believe, is socially appropriate for these works. And because of that, there's no need to think about the question of whether you can publish commercially a modified version. And that means we can envision the idea that commercial publishing could be covered by copyright and limited, but non-commercial redistribution could be everyone's right. Now, this is enough to make it possible to have the existing publication system continue more or less, continue providing the same tiny fraction of the money to authors, if we're really satisfied with such a small fraction in the first place. And so the system of publishing would be basically unchanged, but we wouldn't have to fear the information police, because non-commercial redistribution would be allowed. Copyright would once again become an industrial regulation, not a restriction on the general public. And it might once again be an advantageous policy for the public once its powers are pinned back so they don't attack the general public. The third area, aesthetic or entertaining works, is a hard one for the question of modification. On the one hand, there's the idea that an artistic work can represent the vision, an artistic vision that shouldn't be tampered with. On the other hand, we see the folk process, which manages to improve works and produce things that are very rich if you allow it to function. Some of Shakespeare's plays involve stories that were borrowed from other writers, and if today's copyright law had been in effect then, he would not have been allowed to publish them. Now, he borrowed the stories. Of course, he wrote a very different play. But even smaller changes can be an improvement. I've heard about a film, a very recent film, called Star Trek: The Phantom Edit. Somebody managed to obtain a copy of Star Trek: The Phantom Menace and edit it, rearranging scenes and removing scenes, cutting scenes and so on. He couldn't add any new material. He didn't have the ability to do this in an effective way. All he could do was remove and rearrange, starting from Star Trek: The Phantom Menace. And people who've seen his results say it's better. So it's a hard problem. What should be done about publishing modified versions of these artistic and entertaining works? And I am not really sure of an answer. A few years ago, I thought maybe it would be enough to allow private non-commercial distribution, that maybe it would be okay for copyright to limit public non-commercial redistribution. And then I saw Napster, and I realized that public non-commercial redistribution was tremendously useful, and therefore should not be, that the freedom to do this should not be taken away from the public. The other dimension that I mentioned is how long copyright should last. And it's clear that copyright lasts for far too long. in an age when most books are remaindered in just a few years. Why should there be 70-year plus life copyright or 95-year copyright? It's not necessary to keep publishing afloat. Clearly, we could reduce the term of copyright to 10 years, and the publishing system would basically keep on going. It would make adjustments here and there. And you could argue that it should be even shorter. I was once talking about this on a panel with some admired science fiction writers. And the person sitting next to me said, 10 years, that's ridiculous. Anything more than 5 years is outrageous for copyright to last. And he talked about how he was having trouble reclaiming the copyright from the publisher who'd let his books go out of print. And what you find when you look into this is that the publishers are constantly saying that they're doing this, they're oppressing us for the sake of the authors. And then when you look at how they really treat the authors, they treat the authors like dirt. It's pitiful what publishers do to authors. I believe that part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or at the same time at least, the U.S. decided that studio musicians don't have any copyright in their recordings. It's called a work made for hire, which means they get a lump sum and that's all. The publishers decided that they didn't have quite enough power over the musicians yet. I read an article by an author which ended on the net, which ended up asking people to please cooperate with the copyright system for the sake of authors, and in the process he revealed that his book had been in print for more than 20 years, which is pretty good, and he had ended up making approximately $0.50 per copy, which shows how badly the system functions. He didn't say that. He said the number of copies and the amount of money he made, and I did a division. I've read that the record companies pay out 4% of their sales figures to musicians. In other words, if you buy a CD for $20, the musician is getting maybe a little less than $1 out of that. And because of that, I feel ashamed when I buy commercial CDs. I feel ashamed because I'm not supporting the musicians. I would feel much better in my conscience, speaking as an amateur musician who respects the skills of professional musicians, which are far beyond mine. I would feel much better if I copied the music myself and had a way to send them $2, or maybe even $3. And of course, that 4% is not uniform. A few rich and very successful musicians get eventually to a position where they can negotiate the contracts the way they want to. And they get more than 4% of their sales figure, which means, understanding what averages mean, that most musicians get less than 4% of their record sales figures. Here's how it works. The record company spends some money on publicity for the record, and they charge this as if it were an advance against royalties. So when the records start getting sold, nominally the musicians are getting money from that, but really they're not. They have to sell quite a lot of records before they start to see any money coming in from it. All they get is publicity. That's all they get from their record contract in most cases. Well, publicity is useful. It is important. It means more people will come to their concerts, for instance, and pay them some money, actually. Maybe these people coming to the concerts will buy their records. You know why the musicians really want you to buy their records at their concert? Because then they get the retailer's share. And that they really get. Whereas the royalty share, they probably will never see. And it might be smaller anyway. Surely is smaller anyway. So, this system that restricts the public in the name of the musicians really provides the musicians in most cases with nothing but publicity. Well, I know another way we can provide musicians with publicity, by copying the recordings and sending them to our friends. There's no publicity like word of mouth from somebody who loves the music. We have got to start making the computer net the ally of writers and musicians, instead of letting the publishers convince them to think of the computer net as their enemy. Because that's what the publishers want to do. They want to convince both the musicians and the fans that the computer network is the enemy, that copying among the public is the enemy of the authors and musicians. But the Grateful Dead showed us that that's not true. We have to spread the word about this. We have to show musicians who are making a living mainly through their concerts anyway that they can get better publicity if they are friendly to their fans and say, please copy my music, play it for other people, mail them copies. Not if they didn't ask. They shouldn't ask you to spam. But do let your friends copy the music and realize that that's what's going to get them more fans. And if unless they want to focus everything on the tremendously unlikely possibility of striking it rich, the way that they have a real chance of succeeding is by treating their fans well and encouraging their fans to spread their love of the music to more fans. And I have one further idea for how we can help make the computer networks the ally of writers and musicians. Imagine if we had a convenient way to send somebody a dollar anonymously through the internet, some kind of digital cash system. And imagine that every time you read a book online or play a recording, it displays a box on the screen on the side, not getting in your way, which says, click here to send a dollar to the band or to the writer. Well, if you like the book or the music, you will send that dollar sometimes. After all, it's only a dollar. This dollar is a lot of money in one sense. It's as much as the musicians are likely to get if you buy their CD now. But in another sense, it's very, very little money. It's much less than you would have to spend if you bought their CD now. It's so little money that it's not going to discourage you. You'll probably get in the habit of a couple of times a week paying a dollar to some musician. And the result is you'll be doing as much to support musicians as you're doing now under the copyright system, but it'll cost you an awful less. And one side benefit from this is we'll have better music and better writing. We will break up the hype industrial complex. The music industry, the reading industry, they don't usually use that term, where bestsellers and music is churned out by factories, made out of hype. They take the hype and they press it into a shape. It succeeds by raising a gigantic amount of money to spend on publicity. It gets everybody to want the product of the hype. But if we remove them from the equation, if musicians got their publicity by fans talking to fans, then we would get rid of the distortion and we'd have better music. I love music. I don't want my music to be manufactured in a factory by an industry. I want it to be made by artisans who love what they're doing. So, at this point, I'm ready for questions.
We've got some radio mics in the audience. Could you whip along, please?
I can talk very loud.
They can't hear you. You believe not loud enough for this room.
Thank you. I have a suggestion to deal with copyrights. First, I would separate distribution monopoly, which is included with the copyright rights. So basically, author of any works can decide to charge any percentage of the sale price on their work. But they can't decide who is going to produce the work and who's going to distribute it.
For some kinds of work, that might be an idea to try.
It works for all. There are kinds of works which are difficult.
It doesn't work really for functional works, for software or dictionaries or things like that.
It does.
No, let me tell you why. Because the nature of when these works are free. Oh, I better tell you before you all go. I have these stickers, which I brought here so that you could take them. Let's pass around this. Stickers, or should we? Well, the people. Yeah, okay. Pass it along. Take as many as you can use. Well, that's passing it, all right. Take as many as you feel you can use. Put them in permanent places where people will see them. And there's one other roller. Where's the other roller? There's the bag. The small bag.
Another roll?
Yeah, a different kind. So throw them to that side.
They all say GNU on them.
Yeah, they're all GNU stickers, two different kinds. Oh, well, I guess we'll have to get through. When we get through this part, we'll give them up to the balcony next. The questions are likely to go on for a while. But if you want to leave and just come up and find the sticker distribution and get your stickers. So, once you make a program free, you find that you may get 100 different people who've contributed to it over a period of many years. And then how do you divide up the money?
Well, that is between them to decide.
Oh, but then they'll never reach agreement. You see, because here's the point. Free means that if I wrote the program initially, you have the freedom to make a modified version and publish that. And I must not have veto power, because, you see, I wrote the program the way I like it. Maybe you like something different, and maybe I think it's disgusting and ugly, but if that's what's useful for you, I should have no power to stop you.
Well,
but if you had to reach agreement with me about dividing up the money, then I'd have the power to stop you. I'd just have to refuse to make an arrangement.
It wouldn't make it free, in your sense of free. It would just make it open.
That's not sufficient.
Basically,
it would still,
I'm
sorry, it would be too restrictive to be acceptable. It would get in the way of people's using and developing this. Now, you might say, why should it be a vital freedom, the freedom to commercially publish a modified version? It's not obvious why. But you'll note that you can go to a store and buy free software CD collections, which may have hundreds of different free programs on them. And this is very useful. It takes a long time to download that much. And if people were not allowed to commercially publish these things, our community couldn't effectively fully distribute these programs. So even though you might say there's no moral a priori principle reason why commercial republication has to be allowed, when you start looking how the community uses software, it turns out that that right is essential. So for those kinds of works, this simple, well, you always get, you can always charge a certain percentage, is not usable. And in fact, if you're going to have multiple people changing it and making different versions, you'll find that this finite fraction doesn't work effectively. But if there's some kinds of works where what we decide is there's verbatim copying only is allowed, then there's no, that problem doesn't arise. Then you know who the author or authors are, and that doesn't change. So in those domains, a system like the one you proposed might be usable.
Next question. You've covered some forms of writing and music. What do you see happening for the sort of films and graphical games which currently are produced with multi-million budgets?
Films and what? Computer games?
Graphical computer games, the sort which has large casts of artists.
I think that that is an interesting area. It is more difficult. Maybe what you do is you have some sort of intermediate system. Maybe you do something, you allow non-commercial redistribution only. It turns out, interestingly enough, that the cost of making a film is only a tiny fraction of the cost of the film. Most of it goes into publicity and other kinds of arrangements, business arrangements. It's not the actual production of the film at all. So if we got rid of that, they'd be cheaper. And if people were focusing on... Okay, and the other thing is that the nature of the business to a large extent drives the kind of films people make. They're aiming for blockbusters. They're not aiming for interesting films that have something to say, for the most part, which are cheaper to make. And as computer animation technology and computer editing technology and special effects technology advances, there are a lot of things that become cheaper to make. So it's conceivable that if we just took away copyright from the film business, that we'd have people making films out of love, films that are not so expensive, and that are better. But here's another possibility. After all, you could have copyright covering theater display of films. No problem at all with that. And that's a substantial income stream. So, you know, that keeps the film business going in a somewhat modified form. The situation is complicated. The ramifications of these decisions are complicated. It's not necessarily the case that the film studios go out of business. Depends what precisely what we would do and their various choices available.
I don't think I agree with you that views and essays should be exempt and should be allowed to have copyright, because they're all based on something that someone else has written before and they're built up on that, and I think it's very important that we can take things that one person's written and go on with that and go somewhere else.
Well, I should point out that copyright does not cover ideas. Usually when an essay is based on some other people's thought, which it always would be, what the author has obtained from others is ideas. And in fact, that's not restricted by copyright at all.
What does this do to the software industry as a software professional? Now, the software industry is a large and... multi-billion dollar organization. It's
an industry. Well, I can't hear you, unfortunately, but I heard the beginning. Yeah, I heard the beginning.
What does this do to software as a profession?
Well, I think that that's a secondary question in any case, but let me answer it anyway. Most software development is development of custom software, software destined for use in a certain company. And that won't be changed at all. So most of the jobs will still be there. You know, there may be a certain ratio. You know, maybe it would be 9/10 as many jobs, or maybe only 3/4 as many jobs. Neither of those is a disaster for society, right? You know, this amount of employment in any one field is not a good enough, is not important enough to determine what freedom we should have. But it also partly is depends on social attitudes. If people get used to the idea of paying for support for the free software they use, suppose it's a business using the free software and they want to make sure that their site stays up or whatever, so they might, you know, start making support contracts. The more this catches on, the more it will be a way that programmers get employed. And those companies, which do exist, by the way, now, hire programmers to improve the software. So it's partly a matter of what society learns to accept. Now, once I had the idea that maybe you could develop video games by inviting people to join a game development club, which basically means you put your money in, and you know that every time N people have put in money, they can fund one more game. So if you like those games, you've got a reason to put your money in. The game will come that soon, that much sooner.
I'm an author against copyright. What I'm in favor of is author's rights. My question is, have you looked at all at the system which is common in most countries other than the UK and the US of rights that are personal to authors and which are founded on the principles that you were talking about for the future of the integrity of the work and attribution? Have you looked at the...
Okay, well, attribution, I think, is a perfectly legitimate thing to ask for. And I would have no complaints against laws requiring attribution. The integrity means that the work has not been modified. And I talked at length about the question of for which kinds of works is it important for people to have the freedom to modify and for which should they not. And that depends. For some kinds of works, I think, yes, it's legitimate to say that it can't be modified. For some kinds of works, I say absolutely not, and for some, I'm not sure.
Integrity has the
What if I spend nights and nights writing software, a big company comes, rename it, and sell it for lots of money?
Well, in free software, we usually use a technique called copyleft, which doesn't allow that. The technique of copyleft, which is implemented legally using copyright as a base, that's how it functions, says that everyone has the freedom to modify the program and redistribute it and even sell modified copies, but they must provide the source code and they must pass along these same freedoms to the next person. So that if you had released your program under copyleft, the company could redistribute versions of your program, perhaps modified, but that version would have to be free and copylefted as well, which means you could get it and redistribute their version, and thousands of other people could redistribute their version too, which means they wouldn't be charging that much money for it, probably. So most likely it would be on a CD together with 200 other programs being sold for maybe $50 or $100 for the whole thing. So they wouldn't be charging very much money proportionally for that one program that you wrote.
Hi, I'm from InniMedia, UK.
I completely can't hear you, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Okay, you can.
Brilliant. Basically, not totally against you, but partly. And basically, you talk about the freedom to share with your friends, but all the time you just talk about, you know, what is the product, but not about the process of sharing. And in a way, you talk about computer networks, but you take as a given that the computers are networked and that you got the capacity to share. And basically, I'd like to see what you think of talking about the freedom to communicate, which means the freedom to privatization of the airwaves, you know, like radio and television and all the radioelectric spectrum. All the cables laying down our streets and...
Please. I'm starting to be able to hear, but I couldn't remember that much to answer all of it.
Right. No, basically, would you extend, some of your thoughts into, you know, what is communication? I mean, precisely when now people talk about communication, well, information, technology...
Let me try to answer. Okay, there are different cases which have to be thought of differently. When it comes to using the radio spectrum, it has to be allocated to various uses because stations interfere with each other. On the other hand, computer networks, when you use them for communication, you set up connections, and so everybody can be talking to anybody else. There's no need to pre-allocate it to uses. So that leads to very different conclusions. In the U.S. right now, radio and television are becoming more concentrated. We have a big problem these days of the corporate media that controlled by a small number of corporations that have other interests as well. And so they slant what they publish to suit the interests of the rest of their interests. And as a result, only a very narrow range of ideas can ever get published. Noam Chomsky writes very clearly about this problem, and you are surely aware of Berlusconi in Italy, who has essentially used his monopoly on media to cut off criticism. It's not illegal to criticize Berlusconi, but there's no practical way you can do it on television. But I think that I asked an Italian, how would you say the diminutive of Il Duce? And I think he said Il Duccino. So I think that's what we should call Berlusconi. Especially given that he had the police force the arrested protesters to salute Il Duce. And that was in Genoa. We should call him Il Duccino.
Historically, there have been a lot of different meanings for the word freedom, and they've tended to fall into different camps associated with different authors, politicians, historians, famous people. Which do you fall into, or do you set your own definition?
I'm surely influenced by thinkers in the past, but I don't align myself with a specific camp in that way. And to some extent, I'm not sure who advocated which kinds of freedom first or what. That's something I don't tend to remember well. So I'm not sure who the people are who have influenced me. Sorry, that's not a very helpful answer.
Hi, I'm probably not a very great fan of Microsoft, but Windows has given us one great benefit, which is standardization. Well, okay, most of the world's computers are running Windows, whether we like it or not. Now, in free software, there have been problems with standardization formats, and I would just like to ask...
Actually, no, there are worse formats in Windows, and the reason is that we try to aim for compatibility and interoperability, and Microsoft does not.
Thank you very much.
Question. Would you comment on the...
One other thing I should say on regarding that same question. I don't believe that the benefits of standardization justify forcing everybody to use an unmodified program. If they want to be different, why shouldn't they be different?
Would you comment on the case which opposed South Africa on the right of copying the drugs for AIDS?
Well, I should say, first of all, that it's not really a matter of copying because there are no drug copiers. outside of Forbidden Planet, where the robot was capable of copying all sorts of substances. What they do is manufacture the drug in a factory, and the issue is, that issue is actually very, very different, because there, it's clear that individuals don't have the ability to make these drugs. That's not a legal question. That's just a fact about our level of technology. The issue is, can they manufacture the drug there and make it cheaper, cheap enough that more people can afford it? So that's a very, very different kind of issue. It's a life and death issue, so it's very important, but it's totally different.
I'm sympathetic to your fight against copyright, but I think the way you describe the publishing industry in particular pertaining to artworks like music and films was a bit of a caricature, and I would like to correct this a little bit. Firstly, you distinguished between the production of an artwork and the hype, and the latter was, the way you presented it, irrelevant but very expensive. I think that is mistaken. The hype.
I think you're misunderstanding what I said. On the other, I said just the opposite.
Okay. The second point is that the publishing industry has another function which you haven't mentioned, and that is basically a risk-taking organization, a bank. Basically, the publishers put up a lot of money up front to produce the film, to produce music, and in a very significant amount of cases, maybe 9 out of 10, this money is lost. There's an extreme economy of scale, and if you think that artworks should be published by people who specialize,
I don't believe it.
You don't believe
basically,
it?
Basically, most musicians who get record contracts can't live from them anyway, so it's a lie to say that the record companies fund the production of this music.
What they do is they lure
musicians into accepting contracts that are very, very bad for them, and that commit them to 5 or 7 records before they have a chance to renegotiate with anybody else. For authors, it may be a bit better, but most authors can't make a living from their writing. It's a small fraction who do well enough that they can. Now, it's a good thing, I agree. You know, the basic idea of copyright, the goal that is stated of supporting progress by making it possible to have more publication, that is a worthy goal, but not at the expense of a police state that restricts us. We have to find another way to have the public subsidize this, and that's what it is. I'd rather subsidize something by being taxed and having my money go to it than be subsidized by having my freedom trampled. So I value my freedom more than my money. What time is it? Ah.
Yeah, hi. About the South Africa and the AIDS drugs, isn't this really a patent issue?
Yes, it is. It has nothing to do with copyright. Now, there's a tendency these days for the publishers or owners of copyrights and patents to invite you to lump them together. They have a term that they like called intellectual property. They're inviting you to generalize about copyrights and patents and trademarks and trade secrets and various other things as well, which are all completely different. What the laws say is totally different. There's no detail that's the same. And the origins are separate, and the social effects are different too. So if you want to think about them intelligently, think about them one by one. But the term intellectual property is useful for the owners of these various things because they invite people to see only the simplistic overgeneralizations. If you look at such a broad way, you can no longer see the details that make it possible to recommend intelligent approaches. Now, you notice that I have not said we should abolish copyright entirely. So even when we're talking about just one of these things, what I have to say is not simple. My views on patents are totally different. My views on trademarks are completely different yet again. Well, in software there should be no patents because they obstruct progress, which is the opposite of their supposed purpose.
What about in drugs?
What?
In drugs.
Well, in drugs, it might make sense to have patents in rich countries, but not in poor countries. That way, money is raised to encourage the research, but it's not raised by being squeezed out of poor people who can't afford it. But there's a further point to be made, which is that we must get away from having these drug companies fund research at least university basic research, and also the research to evaluate drugs. You see, a study was done, a sort of study of studies, where they looked at studies of the effects of various drugs, and they saw they compared the results of studies that had been funded by the companies that made the drugs versus studies that had been funded in other ways. And they found that when studies were funded by the companies that made the drugs, they were less likely to report any problems. So in other words, funding the research that way is corrupting it, destroying its usefulness. We must go back to public funding of this research. The public pays for it one way or another, obviously, right? So let's pay for it in a way that makes it, that lets us get something good for our money. And then there are other areas of engineering, say automobile design, where I don't see a tremendous issue about whether there should be patents, and I don't feel I have know enough to have an opinion.
Yeah, I agree with you on what you say about the ethical implications of intellectual property, but...
No, I don't say anything about intellectual property except that it's a confusing term and we shouldn't use it.
Yeah, okay, on the privatization of information then maybe. But the political story I think I disagree on. I was just wondering what you make of quite a conventional interpretation, which is that the trade deficit the United States had is now so vast that the government actually has no choice but to impose ownership.
Why should the rest of the world stand for that from the U.S.?
Because otherwise the dollar would collapse.
The dollar may collapse anyway.
AOL Time Warner may be the U.S. government's best hope of preventing that. I mean, I'm not defending that.
I don't give a damn.
Situation.
Basically, the U.S. dollar benefits from the fact that people all around the world like to use cash dollars. But maybe now they're going to use cash euros. And if that happens, there's going to be less demand for dollars, and a lot of those dollars that essentially have been, where the U.S. government has essentially been allowed to print them and lend them to the rest of the world, well, they're going to come back. So who knows what's going to happen? You know, it's too imponderable. Oh, I don't think I need to sum up. I said what I had to say. Fight against the EU copyright directive. Fight against software patents. Fight against the cybercrime treaty that reinforces the EU copyright directive. All these things have to be repealed.
Thank you.